Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So yesterday we finished up with the third tetrad, contemplations around the mind, and kind of was trying to figure out where to go from there, because we had, Lungpa and I were talking, and logically the fourth satipatthana is what comes up next, but we didn't want to get super into depth with it, because that's what we did 2 years ago for the whole winter retreat. It's a very intense sutta with a lot of wonderful areas to reflect, but more than it seemed reasonable to take on for a few weeks. So what kind of talked about was to just finish up with Ajahn Jeff's section there. It's not very long on the fourth satipatthana, just to round it out. Not on the fourth satipatthana, on the fourth tetrad, just to round out the teaching that he was presenting here, and then just do a little bit of overview with that fourth tetrad and the fourth satipatthana in general, and then leave it at that, and then starting at the next reading, which would be actually in quite a few days from now, maybe to go back and revisit some in more in-depth contemplation of feelings, contemplation of mind, with other suttas that we haven't really gotten into yet. So that's the direction that it seems like we'll be going in. Relative to the fourth tetrad and fourth satipatthana, I just read a little bit from Venerable Anālaya's Satipatthana book, and then finish off with the chapter I talked about in Right Mindfulness. So this is contemplation of Dhammas in the Satipatthana, before we move on to the fourth tetrad in the Anapanasati Sutta. The Pali term Dhamma can assume a variety of meanings, depending on the context in which it occurs. Most translators take the term dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta to mean mental objects, in the sense of whatever can become an object of the mind in contradistinction to the objects of the other five senses. In regard to Satipatthana, however, this rendering appears strange. If the term dhammas were to refer to, quote, objects of the mind, unquote, then the other three Satipatthanas should also be included here, since they too can become objects of the mind. Moreover, one of the exercises listed under the fourth satipatthana is contemplation of the six senses together with their respective objects. So this contemplation of dhammas is not confined to the objects of the mind as the sixth sense only. In fact, the dhammas listed in the fourth satipatthana, such as the hindrances and the aggregates, etc., do not naturally evoke the classification mental objects. What this satipatthana is actually concerned with are specific mental qualities, such as the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors, and analyses of experience into specific categories, such as the five aggregates, the six sense spheres, and the four noble truths. So those five categories and qualities are what is fleshed out in the with the contemplation of dhammas, the fourth satipatthana. These mental factors and categories constitute central aspects of the Buddha's way of teaching, the Dhamma. These classificatory schemes are not in themselves the objects of meditation, but constitute frameworks or points of reference to be applied during contemplation. During actual practice, one is to look at whatever is experienced in terms of these Dhammas. Thus, the Dhammas mentioned in this Satipatthana are not mental objects, but are applied to whatever becomes an object of the mind or of any other sense door during contemplation. The expression contemplation of Dhammas occurs also in the Anapanasati Sutta, in relation to the last four of the 16 steps for developing mindfulness of breathing, which are concerned with contemplating impermanence, fading away, cessation, and letting go. Contemplation of Dhammas in both the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta indicates a temporal progression towards detachment and realization. Although the breakthrough to realization can take place while practicing any of the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, the final four steps appear to be specifically designed to this end. Similarly, although realization can take place while one is engaged in any of the Satipatthana contemplations, the final section of the Satipatthana Sutta concerned with the contemplation of Dhammas stands out for its particular emphasis on achieving this goal. So that's just a brief introduction to the fourth Satipatthana and the fourth Tetrad. And just that last paragraph that I read where he talks about contemplation of Dhammas indicating like a temporal, what he calls a temporal progression towards detachment and realization, is the kind of the full development of that Satipatthana. And as I'm about to read in Ajahn Jeff's, you can also use those contemplations, you know, well before you're close to the edge of realization, that they're very useful contemplations all through the practice, right from the beginning on through to reaching the goal. Any questions so far? Or thoughts? Okay.
Yeah. Oh. I think that kind of presumes a linear approach to
it. Does
practice. That's something I'm not familiar with. That's a thought that
yeah.
It's really not how I've been trained.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's kind of, in my mind, it's like, you know, that's one way of looking at it, and that's one way a person can approach it.
Yeah.
But as we're about to read here, there's, you know, that much broader perspective that you know, that's not so linear. Yeah. Okay. The fourth Tetrad, and this is page 142, chapter 7 in Right Mindfulness. And he starts with just the actual text of the fourth Tetrad. He trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on inconstancy, or impermanence. He trains himself, I will breathe out, focusing on inconstancy. He trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on dispassion, literally fading. He trains himself, I will breathe out, focusing on dispassion. He trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on cessation. He trains himself, I will breathe out, focusing on cessation. And he trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on relinquishment. He trains himself, I will breathe out, focusing on relinquishment. When Majjhima Nikaya 118, which is the Anapanasati Sutta, relates the four tetrads to the four establishings of mindfulness, it connects this fourth tetrad to the abandoning of greed and distress. As we noted in the preceding chapter, this activity can apply to the act of abandoning unskillful mind states that threaten to distract you from the theme of your concentration practice, and to help develop dispassion for concentration itself when all other attachments have been abandoned. However, Majjhima 62, which is the Rahula Awada Sutta, and Anguttara 10.60, which is the Girimananda Sutta, suggests that even before that point, the contemplations associated with step 13, which is the impermanence, inconstancy, can help prevent misunderstandings that may grow up around the very first stages in the practice of concentration. This suggestion derives from the fact that Majjhima 62 lists the development of the perceptions of inconstancy and not-self among the exercises to be done before you start breath meditation. It doesn't give any recommendations for how to develop the perception of inconstancy, but Anguttara 10.60 does. Girimananda. So one section here from Anguttara 10.60. And what is the perception of inconstancy? There is the case where a monk, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, reflects thus. Form is inconstant, feeling is inconstant, perception is inconstant, fabrications are inconstant, consciousness is inconstant. Thus he remains focused on inconstancy with regard to the five aggregates. Majjhima 62, however, note what this perception is meant to accomplish. It helps to uproot the conceit, I am. Because the total uprooting of this conceit doesn't occur until the attainment of arahantship, the question arises, why is this contemplation presented as a preliminary exercise? The answer seems to be that it helps to serve as advanced warning against perceiving the states of concentration induced by breath meditation as ends in and of themselves. After all, they are composed of aggregates, and aggregates are conditioned phenomena. At the same time, in light of Majjhima Nikaya 1.13, the perception of inconstancy with regard to the aggregates serves as a warning against developing pride around those states of concentration as well. And Ajahn Jeff doesn't mention it, but I would also just add something that has come up before, is that those reflections also at that stage, at the stage of the game, you know, in the beginning or the metal before it's fully penetrated, before inconstancy and not self are fully penetrated. It was a point that Tansu Hajo made earlier about they serve, contemplating them now serves as a way of really familiarizing the mind with them as themes to contemplate, so that they're really there ready at the access when the mind is really prepared to understand them on an even deeper level. And just in and of themselves, you know, well before that, just lead to a real sense of calm, peace, and informs us in ways that we how we relate to the world around us in a very useful way. A similar principle seems to be at work in Majjhima Nikaya 62's recommendation of how to develop the perception of not-self prior to breath meditation. Its focus is on applying this perception to form, the body as felt from within. Here, the discourse gives detailed instructions on how to follow this exercise. First, it defines each of the five properties, earth, water, wind, fire, and space, in the same terms used in Majjhima 140. Then, after each of those properties, it states, and that should be seen as it has come to be with right discernment. This is not mine, this is not me, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as has come to be with right discernment, one becomes disenchanted with that property and makes that property fade from the mind. So, again, you know, the Buddha's instructions to Rahula all around the details of contemplating earth, water, wind, fire, and space, each one of those contemplations is taken up, as the earth element becomes apparent in one's awareness, or the fire element or the water element as you're experiencing those, then to also apply that wisdom mind of this is not mine, this is not me, this is not myself, in order to help develop that sense of dispassion, disenchantment. Because, as we have seen, step three in breath meditation involves sensitizing the mind to the effect of the breath on these properties, this exercise would seem to warn against trying to use the breath energy to create a sense of perfect physical health. Which I thought was kind of an interesting comment. I haven't actually known too many people who do that, or try to do that. But It reminds you that the body is best regarded not as an end in itself, but as a tool in the search for a higher happiness. This point, as we will see below, is reinforced by the perceptions of the body's unattractiveness and its drawbacks in leaving you open to the miseries of a wide variety of diseases. Of course, these same contemplations of inconstancy and not-self can be used to develop dispassion for any topics that may threaten to distract you from the theme of the breath or from any of the establishings of mindfulness built around the breath. This is one of the ways in which, even in the early stages of meditation, the contemplation of inconstancy in step 13 leads naturally to the contemplation of dispassion in step 14. There are Giri Mananda Sutta and Anguttara 1060. In its preface to breath meditation, lists a series of other perceptions that can perform the same function. We have already discussed the first, the perception of inconstancy, so here we will just list the remaining ones, beginning with the perception of not-self, which this discourse applies to the sixth sense media. So we've read parts of the Giri Mananda Sutta previously, but I'm just going to go ahead and read Ajahn Jeff's, it's not a summary, but a kind of condensed version of the main points here. And what is the perception of not-self? There is the case where a monk, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, reflects thus. The eye is not self. Forms are not self. The ear is not self. Sounds are not self. The nose is not self. Aromas are not self. The tongue is not self. Flavors are not self. The body is not self. Tactile sensations are not self. The intellect is not self. Ideas are not self. Thus he remains focused on not-selfness with regard to the six inner and outer sense media. And what is the perception of unattractiveness? There is the case where a monk reflects on this very body, from the soles of the feet up, from the crown of the head on down, surrounded by skin, filled with all sorts of unclean things. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, muscle, tendons, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, membranes, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, lymph, blood, sweat, fat, tears, oil, saliva, mucus, fluid in the joints, urine. Thus he remains focused on unattractiveness with regard to his very body. And what is the perception of drawbacks? There is the case where a monk, having gone to the wilderness, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty dwelling, reflects thus. This body has many pains, many drawbacks. In this body, many kinds of disease arise, such as seeing diseases, hearing diseases, nose diseases, tongue diseases, body diseases, head diseases, ear diseases, mouth diseases, teeth diseases, cough, asthma, fever, aging, stomach ache, fainting, dysentery, cholera, leprosy, boils, ringworm, tuberculosis, epilepsy, skin diseases, itch, scab, psoriasis, scabies, jaundice, diabetes, hemorrhoids, fistulas, ulcers, diseases arising from bile, from phlegm, from the wind property, from combinations of bodily humors, from changes in the weather, from uneven care of the body, from attacks, from the result of kama, cold, heat, hunger, thirst, defecation, urination. Thus he remains focused on drawbacks with regard to the body. And what is the perception of abandoning? There is the case where a monk doesn't acquiesce to an arisen thought of sensuality. He abandons it, destroys it, dispels it, and wipes it out of existence. He doesn't acquiesce to an arisen thought of ill will. He abandons it, destroys it, dispels it, and wipes it out of existence. He doesn't acquiesce to an arisen thought of harmfulness. He abandons it, destroys it, dispels it, and wipes it out of existence. He doesn't acquiesce to any arisen, evil, unskillful mental qualities. He abandons them, destroys them, dispels them, and wipes them out of existence. What is the perception of dispassion? There is the case where a monk, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, reflects thus. This is peace. This is exquisite. The stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, unbinding. And what is the perception of cessation? There is the case where a monk, having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, reflects thus. This is peace. This is exquisite. The stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, cessation, unbinding. And what is the perception of distaste for every world? There is the case where a monk, abandoning any attachments, clingings, fixations of awareness, biases or obsessions with regard to any world, refrains from them and does not get involved. And what is the perception of the undesirability of all fabrications? There is the case where a monk feels horrified, humiliated, and disgusted with all fabrications. The perceptions of inconstancy and not-self act as preliminaries to the subsequent perceptions in the list, for they help you view all ideas of self or world simply as processes of fabrication. Viewing them in this light makes it easier to abandon any attachment to them. In particular, the eighth perception in this list, which is distaste for every world, points to the connection between perceptions of self and perceptions of world in the process of becoming. To be a being requires nutriment. Your sense of the world depends on where you look for and find nutriment. If you can see both your sense of self and your sense of the world as processes that are inherently stressful, then the act of abandoning seems less like a sacrifice of necessary nourishment and more like the strategy for true happiness that it actually is. As for the third and fourth perceptions, unattractiveness and drawbacks of the body, they also amplify the perceptions of inconstancy and not-self, providing vivid examples of the stress that comes with looking for happiness in things that are unreliable and lie beyond your control. These perceptions perform other functions as well. As we have already noted, they help to overcome lust. They can help to overcome pride based on appearance or race. They help to overcome fear of death. As we will see in Chapter 9, they also provide a foundation for restraint of the senses. The practice of developing these perceptions prior to the steps of breath meditation is an example of developing insight prior to tranquility. This is one of the ways in which insight helps lead to jhana. Learning to perceive things as processes of fabrication prior to taking on the 16 steps makes it easier to master the steps concerning bodily and mental formation, mental fabrication. To perceive the processes of fabrication as being fueled by passion also makes it easier to understand how step 15 follows naturally on step 14. That is, with the cultivation of dispassion, the processes are deprived of their fuel, so they simply disband and cease. The last step, step 16, focusing on relinquishment, is an essential step in the successful abandoning of any issue that threatens to distract the mind from the beginning stages on up. You not only have to allow the distraction to cease, you also have to let go of any pride over or attachment to your success in allowing that cessation. This frees you to watch for any unskillful states that might arise immediately after the cessation of a particular distraction. This same principle also applies in the final stages of the practice, when you have to abandon passion both for the attainment of the deathless and for the path that brought you there. In this way, the steps of this tetrad roughly parallel the duties with regard to the Four Noble Truths. Step 13 deals primarily with comprehending dukkha so as to give rise to dispassion. That's impermanence. Step 14 develops dispassion to abandon the cause of dukkha. Step 15 realizes cessation. And step 16 deals with the ultimate duty with regard to the path. When fully developed, it is to be relinquished. And then he ends with a couple of quotes illustrating that. Suppose a man were traveling along a path. He would see a great expanse of water, with the near shore dubious and risky, the further shore secure and free from risk, but with neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. Having gathered grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, having bound them together to make a raft, he would cross over to safety on the other shore, independence on the raft, making an effort with his hands and feet. Having crossed over to the further shore, he might think, how useful this raft has been to me. For it was independence on this raft that, making an effort with my hands and feet, I have crossed over to safety on the further shore. Why not I, having hoisted it over my head or carrying it on my back, go wherever I like? What do you think, monks? Would the man in doing that be doing what should be done with the raft? No, Lord. And what should the man do in order to be doing what should be done with the raft? There is the case where the man, having crossed over, would think, how useful this raft has been to me. For it was independence on this raft that, making an effort with my hands and feet, I have crossed over to safety. Why don't I, having dragged it on dry land or sunk it in the water, go wherever I like? In doing this, he would be doing what should be done with the raft. In the same way, monks, I have taught the Dhamma compared to a raft for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of holding on to. Understanding the Dhamma as taught compared to a raft, you should let go even of Dhammas, to say nothing of non-Dhammas. And lastly, when, having discerned as they have come to be, the origination, the disappearance, the allure, the drawbacks, and the escape from these five faculties, the faculties of conviction, persistence, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment, one is released from lack of clinging and sustenance. One is called an arahant. So that's the ultimate in relinquishment. When you've reached the goal, you relinquish the path. So I think that makes very strong and clear comments about how one can use these four aspects of the last tetrad there, four steps all along the way to really contemplating impermanence, developing a sense of dispassion, allowing that to lead to cessation of all sorts of things along the way, and to final cessation, and complete relinquishment too. So any thoughts or questions?
Seen it explicated or thought of it myself, of how that last tetrad lines up with the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, just with the duties, yeah, per se. Yeah.
That was very astute.
Okay.
Annamaya Dhammagataya Sadhukara Gadamase Sadhu Sadhu.